New Thinking Aloud is presented by the California Institute for Human Science, Mind, Body, Spirit University, a leader in fully accredited in-person and online U.S. college degree programs in the topics we cover here. Visit their website at cihs.edu.
Thinking Aloud. Conversations on the leading edge of knowledge and discovery with psychologist Jeffrey Mishlov.
Hello and welcome. I'm Jeffrey Mishlov. Our topic today is super experiencers, and my guest, Sean Esbjorn Hargens, is the Dean of Integral Noetic Sciences at the California Institute of Human Science. This program is one of the only accredited PhD degree programs in the United States where one can study UFOs and other anomalous realities from both a scientific and humanistic perspective. Sean founded and served for 9 years as executive editor of the Journal of Integral Theory and Practice, an academic peer-reviewed journal. And in 2018, he founded the Institute of Exo Studies, through which he is joining others in pioneering the field of exo studies, which draws on over 50 disciplines to help make sense of anomalous and extraordinary experiences of our multiverse in all of its complexity and mystery. The California Institute of Human Science is based in the San Diego area. However, it's largely now an online program reaching students anywhere in the world. Sean currently lives in the state of Maine. And now I'll switch over to the internet video. Welcome, Sean. It's a pleasure to be with you once again.
Yeah, likewise. It's been almost 2 years since we last sat down and have a conversation, so I'm looking forward to seeing where this one goes.
And incidentally, for the benefit of our viewers, our previous conversation was on the topic of non-human intelligence, realms of non-human intelligence, and I'm linking to that video right now in the upper right-hand corner of your screen for viewers who might want to watch it. It's a wonderful conversation. But today we're going to shift ever so slightly and talk about the concept of the super experiencers, which actually is a topic dear to my heart because my book, The PK Man, is an in-depth study of a super experiencer, someone who had psychokinetic activity, poltergeist activity, contact with alien beings, psychokinetic control over large-scale systems, the weather, and so on. In many ways, he was, you might say, an ultimate super experiencer, but undoubtedly, there are many more people out there like that.
Yeah, there are, and I'm really discovering just how ubiquitous it is. I think when I began kind of conceiving of this project a number of years ago, I assumed it was somewhat common, but not very common, but there would be enough people out there to, you know, maybe do an in-depth study of. But now that I'm basically a year into actually launching the research project, and people are emailing me and telling me about all the wide range of anomalous and noetic experiences that they have or have had throughout their life, I'm starting to realize I need to reassess my assumption. And I think, you know, as Michael Murphy points out, this is just the future of the body. This is our innate human capacity to be, you know, in participatory relationship with the multiverse. So I think it's much more common than people realize. And my hope with this research is that it's going to help highlight that. And then it's also going to help us understand some of the different layers and dynamics of individuals who seem to have this wide range of anomalous experiences available to them.
How would you define a super experiencer as opposed to a regular experiencer?
Yeah, I'll do that. But let me just give a little context of kind of how I arrived at the notion of super experiencer, because it kind of helps set the stage. I was noticing in my own life and in colleagues and friends of mine who were having anomalous experiences, and also in the literature, that there seemed to be some individuals who primarily had one kind of, you know, let's call it superpower, right? Where, you know, they would have, you know, a number of angelic experiences throughout their life, or they would, you know, on a semi-regular basis have precognitive dreams that seemed really important and helped them, you know, gain an understanding of their life and future events. Other people might have a series of Bigfoot encounters, you know, and other people who are wanting to have Bigfoot encounters aren't having any of that happen in their life. And so, and also in the UAP space, in the UFO space, which I'm very interested in, you would have some people who are seeing them all the time and other people who would, you know, love to see a UFO in the sky. So I became really curious, like, why are some people having these experiences and other people not having these experiences? And then why do some people seem to have basically kind of one set of experiences and other people seem to have another set of experiences? And I started to hypothesize that it might be related to our multiple subtle bodies and the various inner senses connected to our subtle bodies and our chakras. So that basically kind of the working hypothesis is that, you know, different individuals have different parts of their esoteric anatomy kind of activated and integrated, and that enables them to have different types of perceptual experiences of phenomena that are not part of, you know, general perception or experience in our consensus reality. But then I started noticing that some people seem to have experiences across the full range, right? They were having poltergeist experiences. They were having precognitive dreams. They were having UFO encounters and Bigfoot encounters. And I was just like, oh my gosh, this is crazy. Like, why are these people like so open that they're just like kind of all this phenomena seems to present itself to them at one point or another throughout their life? And then I decided, you know, I was inspired by the Free Research and Ray Hernandez and what they were doing. And I wanted to build on that work because that was about 10 years ago that they ran that survey. And so I decided to reach out to Chris Bledsoe, and who's, you know, well-known experiencer in the UFO space. And then also another person, Melinda Greer, no relationships to Stephen Greer, a different Greer, but she's a retired doctor. And I sent them both an email because I knew they were super experiencers in a sense, right? You know, that term hadn't yet like fully coalesced, but I knew that they were these individuals that just had a lifetime of experiences. Though interestingly, with Chris Bledsoe, his really started after his big event that, you know, happened just a few years ago. But as is often the case, when you start asking these individuals questions, turns out they had a near-death experience when they're young, and they had an out-of-body experience, you know, and there does tend to be phenomena and anomalous experiences that go back way early in their life. So I emailed both these individuals a list of like 30 experiences. I just dumped every possible experience I could think of on this email. And I, you know, it just had so many different possible transpersonal, psychedelic, noetic, anomalous experiences. And I just said, hey, can you just go down this list and next to each item, just write yes, no, or maybe, right? I just want to get a sense of the range of experiences you've had. Melinda responded, and about 75% of the items she said yes to. And that blew me away. I was just like, wow, like an individual who's experienced that full range of weirdness, like that's just crazy cool. So then Chris responds, and Chris had said yes to every item except body marks. And then I thought, oh my gosh, wow, like I'm just scratching the surface here. The feeling I had was if I could have come up with 10 more items and put them on the list, Chris probably would have said yes to most of those as well. So this, in effect, kind of launched the Super Experiencer Research Project. And the way I define it at this point, though, we're in the process of, you know, kind of confirming the operational definition with my advisory board, which I'm very happy and proud to say that you're a member of, Jeff. So thank you again for supporting me in this work in that context. Right now, I'm defining Super Experiencer as an individual who has experienced four or more anomalous categories of experience throughout their life, right? And so that could be that maybe they had a 5 or 6 year period when they were younger, It could be that they had nothing when they were young, but now as an adult, they're having that. And in the recent course that I taught at the California Institute for Human Science, where I'm program director of a master's and PhD program in integral noetic sciences, I just taught an anomalous research practicum course. And in that course, me with over a dozen graduate students began creating the first draft of the survey questions that will be part of phase one of the Super Experiencer Research Project. And we, so far, we've come up with about 500 questions, which is a lot. But the thing is we identified the major categories of experience. And so when I say a super experiencer is someone who's had four or more of these experiences, currently these are the categories that I have in mind, right? So there's out-of-body experiences, near-death experiences, psychic experiences, psychedelic experiences, encounters with non-human intelligences, transpersonal dream experiences, paranormal experiences, UAP encounters, and mystical or noetic experiences. So these nine categories emerged in the context of us doing extensive literature review, talking with a lot of different super experiencers, and trying to get a sense of what are the major camps that these experiences fall into. Now, of course, whenever you're doing this kind of research, it's problematic because people are having a holistic experience in real time that often ticks many of those boxes. So to get them to kind of pull it apart and say, well, this part goes in that box and this part goes in that box, of course, that's challenging and there's limits and there's problems with that. Nevertheless, you know, the way we're designing it is people can tick multiple boxes. They can highlight the links, you know, between these aspects of the experience. But you have to differentiate before you can integrate, right? And so this is the differentiation phase. Like, there seem to be these nine major overlapping, non-mutually exclusive categories of anomalous and noetic experiences that people have. And some people tend to gravitate towards just one or two of them. Some people have four or more. And like you were saying with the PK man, has like six, seven, eight of these, you know, ticked in on his sheet, so to speak.
I would imagine that one of the important characteristics of any super experiencer living in a modern Western culture is that they're surrounded by other people who are in denial that any of this is real.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is, you know, there's a course I'm teaching in the PhD program this fall called What is Real? Scientific, Philosophical, and Occult Perspectives. Because one of the first questions that people ask themselves when they're experiencers or super experiencers is, am I crazy? What's real? You know, and it really raises these existential issues because, yeah, we live in a secular, modernist, scientific, reductionistic, materialist paradigm. And that doesn't lend itself well to being able to make sense of these kinds of experiences. So they're very alienating. And people who have them often don't tell many people about them. You know, many of the emails I've gotten in the last 6 months from self-identified super experiencers who have learned about the work I'm doing, and they send me an email kind of giving me a list of their experiences, they often will say, you know, I've only shared this with a few people. You know, so these aren't things you generally talk about. And this is one of the things I'm really trying to change and challenge with the PhD program is creating kind of a new wave of researchers and thought leaders in this space to really help bring down the social taboo around these phenomenon and enable us to have more interesting conversations about the full range of experiences, weird or otherwise, that human beings seem to have on a semi-regular basis.
I gather that your approach would fit into what is now being called post-materialist science.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's a frame that we use in the program and that I'm using in the context of this research. And just to sketch out the three phases of the research so listeners have a sense of kind of where the research is headed, it's basically a 6+ year project. The first year and a half is launching a survey, a global survey, with, you know, as I mentioned, basically these nine categories. And if someone indicates they've had three or four of them, then they will be then provided with like 20 to 30 questions about that experience, right? So that the survey will kind of dynamically adjust to the number of types of experiences you've had. And from this, we're hoping to get about 5,000 people to fill it out from, you know, all around the world. And then we're going to identify like 100 to 150 individuals for in-depth interviews and then psychometric assessment. And the psychometric assessment, you know, there's going to be like a dozen different instruments used to just establish the baseline of normalcy, to point out that these people are not crazy. These are just average, healthy, psychologically mature individuals who are having these experiences in a wide range of them. Because one of the things that happens is when a super experiencer starts talking about the full range of their experiences, they sound crazy to most people, right? Like, it's one thing for someone to say, yeah, I saw an angel once. It's another thing for someone to say, well, I saw some fairies, and then there were poltergeists in our house for 5 years, and then I had this near-death experience, and I, you know, this happened, and, you know, it's like, then it's like people just shut down, right? So then we'll have these in-depth interviews of like 6 to 8 hours, really going into the phenomenology of the experiences, right? The direct experiences, and really trying to get as much detail about the most significant events in that person's life. And then phase three is going to be doing brain imaging and subtle energy analysis of these individuals, inspired in part by Gary Nolan's work on the basal ganglia and looking at the hyperconnectivity there in the brain, and trying to see like kind of what comes first. Like, do super experiences, are they born with this hyperconnectivity, or through a series of experiences, does it build and develop this hyperconnectivity? Or does it go in both directions, which I suspect is likely the case? So there's three phases. Each phase is 1.5 to 2 years, and we're just getting started.
From what you just told me, though, it seems as if you have a particular bias, which is that the super experiencers are not going to show signs of mental illness. And I wonder why you feel that way.
Well, I do feel that people who have mental illness also have access to these experiences, right? And in fact, you know, the work by Robert Falconer with Others Within Us, he's done a lot of great work to highlight the long history globally of individuals who have mental illness, who have access to different types of encounters and experiences. So I do think that is very much the case. And I think we need to revamp the DSM and our whole kind of mental health professions to recognize that these anomalous experiences are had by people with mental illness and people without mental illness. And that is not linked to kind of mental fitness in that sense. That is more just kind of a basic capacity of human beings. And that mental illness might actually give you certain access to certain kinds of real experiences that in a materialist culture, we tend to write off and just collapse with the mental illness diagnosis just so we don't have to deal with it, right? So these are issues that I want to get at and have the research help shine a light on. But in order to, you know, make certain kinds of progress in the conversation, I think, and also in terms of research and just working with individuals who are able to be part of the research process, we're starting with, you know, your kind of average, healthy individual psychologically and emotionally.
I'm sure there are many people who are very healthy psychologically. I know Vernon Nepi, a neuropsychiatrist, maintains that people who report a lot of spontaneous paranormal experiences have what he called a temporal lobe lability.
Yeah. So this is part of what we're wanting to do in the phase three, is to really do a deep review of the research that's been done up to this point, and to start to identify what are some of the possible, you know, biological and chemical substratums for these kinds of experiences, and also avoid reducing the experiences to that, right? And this is where the post-materialist orientation comes from, because even if there is a God spot of one sort or another, that doesn't mean we can necessarily reduce the phenomena to that biomechanical, you know, brain function, right? So, you know, even if we have an, you know, DMT in the brain naturally, that might just serve as a portal into these other realms that are ontologically distinct from ours, right? So we're definitely going to hold a post-materialist frame, even when looking at the various biological and physical and genetic elements that might be involved.
Post-materialist is a funny word to me, because in a way it suggests what it is not, rather than what it is. How do you view post-materialist science?
Yeah, I have some misgivings about the term. I use it because it's one of the terms out there that people, you know, have a sense of what it's referring to. I think there are either potentially other, you know, alternate terms, or maybe that will emerge. Because, yeah, I think whenever you're defining something in contradistinction to something, it's not as powerful as, you know, what might be the case otherwise. You know, I think often in the context of just the multiverse and the metaverse, you know, and a multidimensional metaverse, right? And that we just live in what I call a wild cosmos, right? Where we're just surrounded by various types of intelligences. And so for me, you know, like Vernon's work, you know, he does a great job of highlighting the complexity of the cosmos we live in. I think we need a new cosmology, right? One that does a better job of making room for all of these phenomena that seem to defy our particular version of physics, right? You know, yeah. So I think that's part of the work that lies ahead, is kind of a new kind of expanded cosmology, and not just the quantum theory consciousness models. I think those are creating a lot of contributions to the conversation, but I think we really have to also draw on the indigenous traditions and their cosmologies, and the esoteric traditions and their understanding of subtle energies, subtle realms, and subtle beings. So there's a lot of work to be done, but it's exciting to be part of the process trying to figure it all out.
Yeah, we seem to live in an environment where certain worldviews get privileged. Like, if it can be reduced down to physics, even quantum physics, it seems to have more status. Whereas if it's some indigenous person talking about their animal spirit guide, we tend to think of that as somehow a less privileged explanation.
Yeah, in exo studies, you know, which is a body of work I've been developing for the last 5 years, there's a number of core concepts that I've been creating and expanding and using kind of in this space. And you've likely heard of Occam's razor, right? Which is, you know, to your point, this idea of like trim it down to the most simplest explanation and then go with that. Well, part of exo studies is doing what I call kind of a double methodology. Where, yeah, if you're going to use Occam's razor, you also have to use what I call Pollock's brush. And here I'm referring to Jackson Pollock, right? Where you have to complexify things, right? As much as you simplify things. And then you compare the simplified version with the complexified version, and you kind of hang out in the creative tension that those two approaches provide, so that you shoot the methodological arrow in both directions, right? Towards simplicity and towards complexity. And you let the juxtaposition of those create new horizons of insight and understanding. So, yeah, I think the overemphasis on simplicity or a single frame is very problematic. You know, my training is in integrative meta theories, where we draw on lots of multiple, even contradictory sets of data, and, you know, and find ways to kind of hold it all in creative tension without collapsing into one absolutism in favor of another absolutism.
I know William James, one of the early pioneers in this field going back to the 19th century, wrote a book called A Pluralistic Universe. And I think his point is that every person, every conscious agent is in effect a universe unto themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, James has always been an inspiration for me, is an important figure in the graduate program. And yeah, I think he would be, you know, look very favorably upon the super experiencer research that we're working on, you know, because he was so great at highlighting the importance of consciousness and the range of experiences that a human being can have. So yeah, I love that you brought up James in this context.
I also have the impression that if I were going to go about looking for super experiencers, I would be very interested in people who are already prominent as spiritual teachers of one form or another, because I find that their lives are typically very rich in this sort of thing. And because of the fact that they are already teaching other people, they have a following, they're good communicators in general, and they have a sense of how to integrate these often very weird experiences in a positive way.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one of the, you know, concepts that I've developed in exo studies is this notion of subtleism. And subtleisms like racism or sexism is basically the disparaging of subtle realm experiences. Mm. And so many of our traditions, spiritual and, you know, contemplative traditions, always often tell the practitioner, ignore that, come back to the breath, ignore that, come back to the cushion, right? And so there's this fear that is going to be a distraction. But when you look at the biographies of almost every spiritual teacher, it's filled with these experiences. Right? Yeah. They have them left and right, right? So it's a very kind of odd thing that there. It just seems like if you're on the spiritual path, if you're purifying the mind stream, if you're purifying the body, that you begin to activate and open up the subtle energies and the subtle energy systems that give you perceptual capacity of these phenomenon. And yet most of the contemplative traditions are very suspicious and worried about these phenomena, even though all their saints and masters and gurus seem to have them in spades. So I find this a bit disingenuous in a sense. And I feel like we're at a point where as humans, we can embrace those cities and those superpowers and those experiences. Of course, they can be a distraction. Everything can be a distraction. The ego can take anything it wants and turn it into a distraction. So I don't find the kind of, you know, the position that, oh, ignore it because it's a distraction, that helpful. It's like, no, let's explore it. You know, in a tantric sense, let's use it as part of the path, right? Everything is part of the path. So I think you're right that a lot of our spiritual teachers have these experiences, and sometimes they're not as open and forthright about it as they might like to be because of kind of the cultural, social taboo around this. And they might emphasize certain kinds of experiences that are more associated with the tradition or lineage that they're representing.
That's certainly the case, even within spiritual circles, particularly, I think, colored by the Victorian mentality. There is this sense, you know, we don't want to go there. And I suppose, ultimately, spirituality is about engendering love and compassion in people. That needs to be, I think, central.
I've had several people share with me experiences like the following. You know, like a traditional Buddhist meditator on the cushion doing Vipassana meditation, and then all of a sudden in his meditative experience, basically a great alien shows up standing next to the meditation cushion. And he's going, my gosh, what's going on, right? And then the gray alien disappears, and then he goes to his teacher, and his teacher just says, ah, just ignore it, right? And it's like a lot of the teachers actually aren't very well equipped to support their students with the full range of experiences they might have, and they just have this mechanical response of like, oh, that's not part of our tradition, so don't like engage it, ignore it, and just come back to the focus of the practice. And on the one hand, I can appreciate that kind of focus and clarity. But on the other hand, I feel we're at a point where it's doing a disservice and that we need spiritual teachers who are more capable of supporting the wider range of anomalous experiences that their, you know, Sangha practitioners, students, followers are having. Because I've had many people share one, a version of that story with me. So I know it, you know, happens, you know, on a semi-frequent basis.
Well, many traditions, particularly Tibetan Buddhism, suggest that these non-human entities, one could think of them as deities, have a role as guides and teachers.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And then, you know, I just taught a course on entity encounters where we looked at 10 major categories of entities. And even here, you find like, yes, the Tibetans are very good at embracing a certain set of non-human intelligences. And they often, the bodhisattvas have a wrathful and a peaceful expression, right? But then there's, you know, even some types of beings that are not included in that cosmology that get left out. So even in the cosmologies that do a good job of including three or four or five major classes of non-human intelligences, they tend to still be leaving out or ignoring another set of five different types of beings, right? So I find this over and over again, where there's no kind of cosmology that really is inclusive to the full range of non-human intelligences that humans seem to be having regular contact with, right? And so we can learn a lot from Tibetan Buddhism. Likewise, with indigenous cosmologies, like, they include Sasquatch, right? You don't hear the Tibetan cosmology including Sasquatch so much, right? So there's different kinds of beings that are embraced and understood and normalized in various cosmologies. And so, you know, how do we navigate that, right? How do we do the comparative contrasting across these different, you know, kind of spiritual systems to have a full view of the wild cosmos that we seem to be inhabiting alongside many other types of beings, you know, alternate human beings as well as non-human beings.
You mentioned the grays earlier, and of course, in the last, let's say, 50 years, there's been an enormous body, I'll call it folklore for the moment, having to do with the grays. And it doesn't appear to me that one sees anything exactly like the grays in earlier mythologies or traditions.
Yeah. The grays are a very fascinating group of beings. You know, I've talked to Peruvian shamans who lead ayahuasca ceremonies who have said to me that sometimes the grays show up in the ayahuasca ceremony and they just tell them to go away. I've also had a Tibetan Rinpoche basically say the same thing during, you know, doing a big puja and ceremony. And they're just like, yeah, we know who they are, but we ignore them. If you look at Artie Six Killer Clark's work, she's an American Indian from Montana that's done a lot of ethnographic research with indigenous peoples in North America. She highlights through her interviews that the American Indians make a distinction between our star ancestors, you know, their star ancestors, and the grays, right? So, you know, there are a lot of interesting data points that the grays seem to be a very kind of unique group of beings. You know, if you look at psychedelic experiences, right, whether you're on DMT or even marijuana or, you know, any number, ayahuasca, you know, any number of the sacred medicines and otherwise, you have reports of grays showing up across all those different, you know, modalities, across, you know, all those different types of psychedelic substances. So the grays seem to kind of be everywhere, right? And so I think, you know, there's a way in which we kind of have packaged up the grays as kind of a cultural icon that represents aliens. And I think it allows us to dismiss them in a way that isn't so helpful. I think there's a lot there that we should be paying attention to. And I think, you know, they even get wrapped up with just the abductions, right? They're the ones driving the abduction process. That's another kind of dismissive move, right? I mean, I think the abduction phenomena is really important and we need to look at it, and it's very scary and overwhelming. But, you know, Mary Rodwell suggests that there's over 100 different types of grays, right? You have other people who report that there are dozens of different types of gray. So even the label gray might not be a very adequate or useful label, because it is referring to lots of different groups that are then, they just look similar and we just clump them together. Right. So we need a much more dynamic cosmology to even start to try and navigate the complexities of what I suspect we're dealing with here.
There's a Buddhist sutra. It goes something to the effect that form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. It sort of suggests that conscious spiritual beings can take any kind of form. We could project a single person can project an apparition of themselves in any form that they wish to imagine. There's no limit to my understanding.
Yeah, so there's a whole category of thought forms and tupas, to refer to the Tibetan tradition, where individuals with, you know, who have developed powerful capacities of concentration, or if they're just in a very emotionally intense situation, that can be enough to create a thought form of, you know, a wide range of thought forms, either a doppelganger of yourself or, you know, another kind of person or a being. So, you know, and this is a category of of entity in and of itself, the thought forms. And part of what makes understanding the realms of non-human intelligences so difficult is many of the beings, when they're interacting with us, they can choose to present in a certain way, or they can tap into our own image bank and draw out images that we're expecting, right? And then there's also our own projection, right? So I refer to this dynamic in two ways, as mutual enactment, right? Where they bring something to the table, we bring something to the table, and there's a dynamic participatory space that kind of mutually enacts them and us. Now, that's not to reduce the ontological distinction between them and us, but it is to say that because we're in a space that's informed by consciousness in a way that seems to be a little different than our material gross realm, that there's a dynamism at play. And then the other word I use and concept is cosplay with a K, right? Where these beings are dressing up in images that they want to dress up and to present to us in a particular way. You have a great example in Contact, right? Where Jodie Foster's on the beach. She's encountering her father. And then she realizes, because the alien is explaining, that he's showing up as the father because that's an easier form to make contact with her in. And so we're left to imagine that their true form is not that, right? It's something much different, right? So that's kind of an example of this cosplay. And so, you know, when we're dealing with the subtle realms, one of the moves that I see the traditions make, or that I would call subtleism, is when it comes to subtle beings, they point out the emptiness side of the Heart Sutra, right? You know, the form is emptiness. Like, oh, that's empty. And so they kind of dissolve it in emptiness. But as you pointed out, the Heart Sutra says it both ways. Form is emptiness, but emptiness is also form. Like, so these are actual forms. These are actual beings. There's a range of, autonomous to semi-autonomous, right? Like, there's a lot of things for us to sort out. But just as you and I ultimately are the single original face, right? There's no difference between you and I at a certain point if we zoom out enough into non-dual awareness. But here you and I are sitting in different parts of the country using technology to connect. So there is a way in which we're different, even though we're form and we're different, even though there's another way we're the same and we're empty of our individual personalities, right? So likewise with these subtle beings and these non-human intelligences, you know, they are different and they're the same, right? And so that's something that we have to keep kind of sorting through, because we have so much fear around them as existing ontologically distinct from us.
It suggests to me, Sean, that anyone who wants to get engaged in this area that you're pioneering, noetic sciences, is going to need to be comfortable addressing paradoxes.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Paradoxes are at the heart of it. You know, one of the core concepts I'm developing in exostudies is doubleness. And this kind of draws on a notion that Jeffrey Kripal has written about in many of his books. And doubleness is how the phenomenon, whether we're talking about poltergeists or UAP encounters or angelic visitations, that there's often a doubleness to it, right? And doubleness shows up across three major categories. At an individual level, it shows up as being both inside and outside at the same time, right? Or what's happening inside manifests outside, or what's happening outside manifests inside. And there's kind of the normal boundary between inside and outside becomes very porous, and it's not, you know, very helpful in trying to determine what one is experiencing. The other is in relationship between self and other. That which seems other often gives a reason to believe that it's self. And then also you as self sometimes start to feel like you're the other. And so it blurs the boundary between self and other, right? You sometimes have this with channelers, where channelers who have been channeling a certain being for a very long time, all of a sudden after like 5, 10, 15 years, will then realize or share that the primary being that they challenged is actually themselves on another timeline in another dimension, right? So that's an example of that being simultaneously being other and self. Right, people who have encounters with ETs, right, or even Whitley Strieber's encounter with the female gray-like being, right. There are many points where he's describing it as being both very familiar and very foreign, right. Both being himself and being something truly alien, right. So the self-other dynamic gets involved, and there's another kind of doubleness and paradox. And then the third major area is just around time and space, and the time dilations and the bilocation and space and time gets all mixed up and turned around, right? So the phenomena at its core seems to be paradoxical, right? Regardless of what kind of anomalous experience you're talking about, you know, and we see, you know, even Jacques Vallée talks about how the phenomena will erase the evidence it provides, self-erasing evidence, right? So again, it's this paradox, like it leaves evidence, but then often the evidence isn't worth much, right? And it's confusing, right? And yet there is evidence, but there's not evidence, right? So absolutely. And this is part of why in the program that I run, there's a focus on integrative meta theories, because integrative meta theories, and you know, Vernon Nepp is an example of one of those, is that you have to become more comfortable with ambiguity, uncertainty, and paradox. And because, and that's part of being a, in a quote, post-materialist frame, right? You know, it's getting out of the simplicity. It's getting into, you know, Pollock's brush, painting a wild, crazy picture, not just for the sake of, you know, adding complexity, but in a way that's anchored in the data, right? You know, Kripal and Mike Cleland have made this point that the weirder it is, the truer it is, right? And they're referring to conversations they've had with experiencers and super experiencers where, like, the first time they have the conversation, the individual shares a little bit about some weird encounter. Then, like, a week later, they share a little bit more. And then a week later, it just gets stranger and stranger. And Kripal says when this happens, he really, you know, embraces the authenticity of the experience, because people are not wanting to be forthcoming with that level of weirdness. And they're just slowly trusting you, and they're slowly revealing the next item behind the curtain, right? So this whole idea that if it's weirder, it's truer is a paradox, right? Because we have this idea that if it's weird, it's not true. So I think, you know, a big part of this is the need for integral awareness, integral models and maps that allow us to hold a lot of the paradoxical data points in a creative tension together.
Let's talk for a moment about the California Institute of Human Science and the amazing work that they've done to take a program such as yours and have it approved by the Western Association of Schools and Colleges for academic credit.
Yeah, I'm really proud of this program. I'm really, you know, happy that CIHS, California Institute for Human Science, has been supporting me in this endeavor. I'm really excited that, you know, we have WASC approval. There's no program like this on the planet, right? It's really unique. We're partnering in various ways with the Institute of Noetic Science, right? And so CIHS has, you know, four major programs. And my program is called Integral Noetic Sciences. It's got a master's and a PhD track. It started 2 years ago, right after you and I talked last. It was launched in spring of 2022. It's been growing. We have over 30 students now, which is super exciting, given it's just been around for 2 years. And it weaves together many of the elements we've been talking about. It weaves together integrative meta theories, contemplative science, so like studying the brain and meditators, esoteric studies, anomalous and noetic experiences, subtle energies, UAPs and consciousness, and non-human intelligences and entities. So the program outcomes, like, so for students who come into the program, kind of the five things we guarantee they're going to get by doing this accredited degree with us are they're going to learn how to compare and contrast multiple comparative and esoteric traditions. They're going to focus on their own personal development. They're going to learn to do mixed methods research, which is using qualitative and quantitative methodologies. And because we're dealing with post-materialist realities, we're developing new innovative methods, drawing on feminist methodologies, indigenous methodologies, transpersonal methodologies, anomalous methodologies, because there are not many institutions that are trying to study the kinds of phenomena we're trying to study. And one of the things that really sets us apart from our sister school, the California Institute of Integral Studies, which is where I got my PhD, is our focus on mixed methods and post-materialist science, right? We really emphasize science, but not science in the traditional reductive, secular sense, more transpersonal, holistic, you know, interesting kinds of integrative science. And so we have basically four kinds of concentrations that a student can choose to do in the program. If they're a master's or a doctoral program, either they don't have to do a concentration, but they can if they want to focus, you know, their studies in a particular area. One is on wisdom design. And so that's using, you know, contemplative studies to help design organizations, educational programs, and so forth. One on anomalous studies, which is just kind of widely, you know, all the weird experiences that people have. Then there's a new concentration that we've just put together in UAP and consciousness studies. The UAP topic has really exploded in the mainstream in the last, you know, 4, 5, 6 years, right? Since the 2017 New York Times article. And there are many institutions that are getting involved with this topic, but none of them are focusing on the consciousness aspects. They tend to focus on the tech side. And so I think that's one of the unique things that we're doing is we're really looking at how does consciousness individually and collectively interface with the study of UAPs and the various beings that are part of that, you know, experience space. And then students can also design their own concentration in collaboration with me. And so, for instance, they could do something on subtle energy studies or psychedelic studies or contemplative science or parapsychology, though I will say we're in the process of putting together a program in collaboration with you, and I'm hoping we're able to launch that as soon as possible. And so together, students in this program, they research the experiential, phenomenological, and transformative potential of these extraordinary anomalous experiences. And they learn to investigate scientifically using mixed methods, as I said, the relationship between consciousness and the phenomenon, including subtle energies. And then we also explore the philosophical, ethical, and ontological implications of this. And now I know ontological is a big word. It basically means the position that these things are real in some meaningful way. And too often I find in academic circles or even religious, spiritual, contemplative circles, there tends to be a de-emphasis of the ontological aspects of these phenomena. Because it's too confronting to our mainstream worldview. We want to psychologize it. We want to pathologize it. So in this program, we really are open to and take a hard look at the potential ontological realities that we're dealing with. And one thing that's really interesting about this program is students and faculty are experiencers, and some of us are super experiencers. And we talk about that in our classes. We bring that into the conversation. We normalize it. I mean, it's amazing to be in a graduate WASC-accredited program and in a, you know, 1.5 hour session have a student talk about a ghost they grew up with in their house, another person talk about a precognitive dream they had 2 weeks ago that just came true, and another one share a UFO experience they had 10 years ago that they've never shared with anyone. Right? That's the kind of thing that happens in some of our classes. And so student research is focused on intuition, parapsychology, ET contact, integral application to police departments, prison reform, spiritual entrepreneurship, and subtle energy research in nature. And we got a lot of great courses. So I'll stop there. That's probably more than enough. But hopefully it gives you and your listeners a sense of what an amazing opportunity is for people who are looking for a rigorous, systematic, accredited, you know, program, unlike anything on the planet that's dealing with anomalous phenomena, integral realities, and UAP and consciousness studies.
Now, I know that CIHS refers to their programs as being both online and in the classroom. And I know you right now are in the state of Maine. CIHS is located in California near San Diego. How do you balance the in-person classroom studies with the online?
Yeah, so all of the courses in my program are online. We're in the process of building out more courses to be held in person on the campus in Encinitas, which is, as you pointed out, near San Diego. We were all on campus before the pandemic. And with the pandemic, it pushed all the courses and programs online. We got special permission from WASC to do that. And then after the pandemic, we had to apply for kind of permanent permission to continue in that mode, which we have received. And so we're rebuilding the kind of on-campus offerings, but the majority of courses are offered online. And as a result, an individual from anywhere in the world can participate and get an MA or a PhD in integral noetic sciences. You don't have to take on-campus courses if you don't want to. But for those who live in the area or want to move to the area, you know, we are increasing the number of courses that are offered on campus. We also have public programs that are offered on campus. And so we're going to continue to kind of build out, you know, that aspect, you know, over time.
Another question I'm sure many prospective students will have is, what are they going to do with a degree like this? It's not as if the corporate world is going to offer them high-paying jobs on a silver platter, or even the academic world.
A lot of individuals already are in a career that they're happy with, that's in the healing professions, or it's, you know, dealing with the kinds of topics that they would be learning about. And so they're doing it more to just increase their visibility, to, you know, be able to charge more for their workshops or their one-on-one sessions. We do have some students who are transitioning careers. And so with this degree, people either go into research, they go into education, or they go into business, right? Like founding nonprofits or, you know, doing leadership in, you know, different business organizations. Right. So today in our conversation, we've kind of highlighted the anomalous studies and the UAP and conscious studies. There is a whole side to the program that focuses on the integrative meta theories and the application of those meta theories to, you know, prisons, to police departments, to business, to law, education, environment. So there's a lot of different applications that, you know, people are planning on doing with the degree or could do with it. And I'm always happy to chat with people to hear their individual kind of desires or trajectories to help them really assess if this degree would enable them to move forward in their professional trajectory in the way that they want. So I have a lot of those conversations because, as you pointed out, it's not always obvious what you do with this degree. And for some people, the topics are just so important. They just want to dive in and become a researcher and learn more about this, and then they kind of figure it out as they go, right? So that's always another possibility.
I recall many years ago, I had a similar conversation about a Rudolf Steiner-based college, Emerson College, and at that point, they told me, we are not training people to go out and find a job in the job market. We are training people to go out and create jobs.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I think that applies here as well. Though we do take it the responsibility of helping our graduates find jobs, we take that very seriously. So it's important for us that the degree has professional relevance. That said, the point you just made coming out of Emerson College is also very true. For many of our students, they're thought leaders and pioneers, and they're helping to create the next wave of jobs and professional activities. So we see, you know, a healthy dose of both of those scenarios in our situation.
Well, Sean, it's been a pleasure talking to you. You're doing incredibly significant pioneering work. I don't know of anything comparable anywhere, certainly in the Western world and probably across the entire globe as well. So I commend you, and I'm looking forward to further discussions with you as your work progresses.
Absolutely. Yeah, thank you for the conversation today, and I look forward to our next conversation.
Thank you for being with me, Sean, and with the New Thinking Aloud audience. And for those of you watching or listening, thank you for being with us, because you are the reason that we are here.
Three in the New Thinking Aloud dialogue series is UFOs and UAP. Are we really alone? Now available on Amazon.
You can now download a PDF copy or order a beautiful printed copy of issue 6 of the New Thinking Aloud magazine.